To shoot. Crossover. Up, under, and in! 1.1 left. Houston and the Cougars with 33 wins and a number 3 seed are coming out of Tulsa, and they are heading to Kansas City in the Sweet 16.
And as a 5 seed, the Houston Cougars are moving on to the Elite Eight.
The dream is alive for Houston. For the first time in 37 years, the Cougars are going to the Final Four.
Welcome to the Scott Holman Podcast. I'll try not to monologue too hard here at the top of our show, but when the two of us started this little humble podcast nearly 8 years ago and 400-something episodes ago, I think the thought of the two of us coming together and talking about Houston Cougar men's basketball playing in the second weekend of March Madness, it would have seemed like a wildly optimistic thought. I mean, after all, U of H 2 at that point had only made one tournament appearance since 1992. It was a very enjoyable appearance, a completely out of nowhere run through the 2010 Conference USA tournament that allowed Tom Penders to leave on a high note and end in a quick, decisive first round exit against Maryland. But outside of making the dance, U of H hadn't even won a game in the event since 1984, since the last year of Fight Slam Jam before the two of us were born on this earth. And I think as much as when we started this podcast, we were two people who were very excited about the Kelvin Sampson hire, I don't think we let a difficult first year running the program really shake our long-term faith that he was the best hire U of H could have made. But I think at that time, simply getting to the round of 64s net large would have seemed almost like a fever dream, an incredible achievement that was really unlike any we'd seen from this program in several decades. And that now we sit here talking about a program making its fourth straight appearance in the second weekend of the NCAA men's tournament, it's amazing. And even acknowledging that this U of H team as a one seed and a team that spent a not small part of this regular season ranked number one, that this was the kind of team that should have had those expectations, I think. I mean, there are not an insignificant number of teams right now who had second weekend or later aspirations who have now seen their season come to an end. Dustin, the defending champions, a one seed, they lost to an SEC team who had a sub 500 conference record. The Big Ten regular season and tournament champions, as you probably know if you're listening, lost to a 16 seed who got in on a technicality, had to win a first four game to even get that matchup with Purdue, the aforementioned Big Ten regular season and tournament champions who were no longer in the dance. This is kind of a meandering way to say that even with the potential of several games left in this tournament, even with very high expectations that have shaped the last 9 or 10 months of chatter around Houston Cougar men's basketball, I think we should all still not lose sight of what rarefied air this program is in right now. Okay, I've monologued enough, Dustin, my good friend, my co-host. How are you doing, friend?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I got to be honest, the way that the tournament, the first weekend played out with all the aforementioned upsets that you talked about there and Houston playing banged up against Auburn and, you know, in Alabama, it felt like this might be, you know, this might be finally the season where things don't really go Houston's way over the first weekend of the tournament. But remarkably, like you said, fourth straight Sweet 16. So, yeah, not something I thought I would ever have to worry about Houston. Oh, no, we might not make it to a fourth straight Sweet 16. But even that ridiculous champagne problem of like, oh, maybe we're finally going to get a first round upset. Even that did not even come true. And Houston on to a fourth straight Sweet 16, as you said. I keep repeating myself, but it's that remarkable. I still can't get over it. It still feels pretty remarkable coming out of my mouth. Four straight Sweet 16, Sam. Didn't think I'd have to didn't think we'd be worried about that.
Yeah, it's just I keep pinching myself. Even knowing back as far as last June that if Marcus Sasser comes back with all the other guys that are projected to come in and return, that this is a team that's going to have just about the highest expectations on it. It's really incredible. Single elimination tournaments like March Madness. There's a reason why Madness is half the name there. It is your 40, even just 20 minutes of bad basketball. I mean, I'm sure Auburn and Auburn's fans couldn't help but think about, you know, a potential surprise tournament run for that team after the first half they'd had against the Cougars. It could all go south or really go your way, I guess, if you're going from a Cougars perspective on this one in 20 minutes of basketball. It's the beauty and the agony of this, I think, you and I's favorite collegiate event, maybe favorite sporting event that's a recurring postseason thing, period. But before we get into that, before we get into the great topic that is Houston Cougar men's basketball, you probably know I'm going to say here at the top, but please, if you haven't done so already, please check out our good friends and network partners, the 1012 Network, talking all things Big 12 over there on the 1012 podcast and a number of fantastic school and even sports-specific podcasts. Do follow them on Twitter at TEN12Network if you don't do so already. And also, if you are doing so already, please consider supporting our little podcast financially for as little as 16 cents a day. Go to patreon.com/SHPAWDcast. You won't just be supporting us as we use our limited spare time to create weekly Cougar content, but you're also getting access to a premium collection of episodes that I promise will be updated here in short order, including perhaps a little Bat and Ball Sports exclusive that we are working on. That's patreon.com/SHPodcast. Of course, last but not least here, please check out our good friends at the good brand, Homefield Apparel, homefieldapparel.com, the makers of incredibly comfortable premium vintage collegiate apparel. If you follow Homefield even a little bit, you probably weren't surprised by the fact that within 24 hours of the crazy Fairleigh Dickinson upset of Purdue, that Connor and the folks over at Homefield didn't just have a licensing agreement in place with Fairleigh Dickinson, but also launched a fantastic FDU collection, my personal favorite being the navy blue tee with the knight holding a big lance and also a basketball. And I think that's part of why we like them so much. Homefield isn't just a company focused on the big names, the highest profile fan bases, that they're going to put as much thought into a Fairleigh Dickinson or St. Peter's collection as they would any of the big names that are also a part of their collection of hundreds of schools, including your Houston Cougars. And of course, got to mention that you could save 15% off your first order if you haven't ordered it yet. Absolutely no judgment here. Use the promo code HOLMAN12, HOLMAN12, save 15% on that first order, no matter your school of rooting interest. Dustin, wanted to get you in here because you were the recipient of Homefield's incredibly cool Mystery Mania shirt promotion, were you not?
Yeah, they're doing a Mystery Mania shirt promotion over March Madness, where for a vastly discounted rate over their normal t-shirt rate, you can get 6 t-shirts total. You get 2 each weekend that kind of arrive each weekend of the NCAA tournament. So each weekend you get 2 new shirts from 2 teams that are still alive in either the men's or the women's basketball tournament. And then you get, and includes the final weekend, you get a national champs shirt that is going to be then exclusive to that collection. So very excited to be signed up for that. Got my first weekend shirts, got a sweet TCU shirt with the jacket wearing or coat wearing horned frog, which is very cool. My partner's delightful Uncle Scott, which excellent name, is a TCU alum. So excited to take some pictures and send and let him know that I'm gonna be supporting the horned frogs for him in the future. Got a nice Nova Nation Villanova Wildcat shirt for that. I'm very excited as well. We'll wear it a little bit begrudgingly, of course, because Nova knocked us out in the Elite Eight last year, but still a very cool shirt, and very excited to be extending my own personal Homefield Apparel t-shirt collection.
Absolutely fantastic stuff. So that's Homefield Apparel, homefieldapparel.com. Support our partners and look good doing it. Though, now that we've got all the housekeeping done, we got to talk about an unforgettable opening weekend of March Madness that saw the Cougars keep their championship hopes alive at least for another week. Dustin, you may have already seen this factoid floating out there. Either way, do you know how many other programs in Division I men's basketball have made the past 4 Sweet 16s like the Cougars have done?
I do not. I'm going to say it's like 2 or 3 is my guess.
You're close. It is 1. It is the Gonzaga Bulldogs. That's the only other team that has been to the Sweet 16 at least of the last 4 tournaments. Like, that is that's incredible. It's Gonzaga. That's pretty rarefied remarkable. Air. Only two other programs out there that are even making their third straight appearance here in the tournament's second weekend. That would be Arkansas and UCLA. I find the UCLA one kind of funny, Dustin, because for all those years, Mick Cronin had incredible regular season Cincinnati teams. He goes to UCLA and magically figures out how to get to the second weekend. I'm sure there's some Bearcats out there maybe a little bit bitter about that. But, I mean, Kansas, I alluded to that, I think, at the top of the show. The current defending Division I men's champion, they've only been to the second weekend one of the last 4 tournaments. Granted, that one, they won the whole thing, so that, I think, takes this thing out a little bit. Kentucky has only been to one of the last 4. That was actually, Dustin, that one was the year that they knocked the Cougars out in the 2019 Sweet 16. Duke, UNC, and Michigan State have only been to 2 of the last four. I'm not saying all of those factoids to take a dig at any of those programs, well, except maybe Kentucky, but I think I just wanted to illustrate for everyone listening that even when you have all of the postseason tradition, all the resources on your side, that making this round, making this point in the tournament year in, year out, is extremely difficult. I mean, but for an extremely high difficult degree of difficulty Jordan Poole three-pointer, Dustin, we might actually be talking about five straight trips the second weekend. I think that's pretty unreal and a statement of what Kelvin Sampson and all the guys that have come through this program the last 5 years have done. And I mean, the goal is always to be the last team standing. The goal is to be the team cutting the nets down, one shining moment playing, all that jazz. But I really just don't want any of us in this fan base to lose sight of where this program is right now. That there are 347 fan bases and Division I men's basketball programs out there that would gladly trade places with the Cougars and everyone else who are still remaining in this tournament right now.
Very funny to me, by the way, as much as there's a certain segment of the college basketball fandom that wants to believe that teams outside of the Power Six don't deserve high seeds in the tournament. The two teams that are consistently winning games in the tournament every year are Houston and Gonzaga, two teams not in the Power Six. But yeah, you mentioned just how hard it is to consistently win games in the tournament with, you know, Houston and Gonzaga, the only teams four straight Sweet 16s. You mentioned earlier as well, you know, Purdue and Kansas losing in the first weekend as one seeds. Not only that, but I mean, you saw teams like Arizona and Marquette as two seeds losing in the first and the second round respectively. And I mean, you know, Purdue, Kansas, Arizona, Marquette, those teams were all really, really good teams that had really, really good seasons. They have good coaches, and not one of them is playing basketball anymore this year. So big-time upsets, very much the norm for March. They were very much, even by March standards, in the air this past weekend. And the Cougs got a challenge in both of their games. Northern Kentucky keeping that one uncomfortably close for most of the game. Auburn taking a 10-point lead into halftime before Houston blew past them in the second half. And, you know, kind of the good problem to have when you're a one seed on opening weekend is that you can only kind of do what you're quote-unquote supposed to do, or you can get upset and have everybody gawking at you, as we are to those other teams right now. And certainly, you know, Houston had obstacles thrown at it in terms of, you know, Marcus Sasser re-aggravating his groin injury in the NKU game and not playing the second half, to other guys getting banged up in that game, and then, you know, playing a quick turnaround in a road environment and falling behind early. You know, so Houston did not waltz into the Sweet 16 this year the way that they did in, you know, 2019, or even, you know, relatively speaking, last year, although Illinois was kind of pesky in that one for a while. But, you know, what Houston did do is, you know, yes, it's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason. They survived and advanced. And you may notice that one of the years I didn't mention in terms of Houston waltzing into the Sweet 16 was 2021, a year that they very much did not, as they got a hell of a scare from Rutgers in the second round. And obviously that close call did not prevent Houston from winning its next two games and advancing to the Final Four that year. So, you know, looking back at this past weekend, all in all, you know, was it an ideal stress-free weekend to be a Cougar fan, where you just didn't have to have any doubt about whether Houston was going to move on? No, you didn't get that. But any weekend you advance through alive is a good one, especially since you figure Marcus Sasser and Jamal Shedd and everybody else ought to be healthier this coming weekend when the Cougs get back in action.
I'm going to ask you something that I don't think either of us has in our notes back from that 2021 tournament. Obviously, I remember the Tremond Mark just absurd putback that I think put the Cougars up for good in the closing seconds of that Rutgers round of 32 game. Didn't the Cougars trail nearly the entirety of that game?
I believe the majority of that game they trailed. I don't know what the actual game time was, but yeah.
And so that was the team that advanced deeper than any other. If you're a Cougar fan that is still, and I don't think there's many of y'all out there, if any, that are still worried about the style points of the Northern Kentucky game, which is where we will start talking about the past week that was. And I think something that was on my mind going into that Thursday night opener against the Norse was, how is this Cougar team going to deal with their first game as the one seed? I mean, there was obviously all the kind of background noise about Marcus Sasser. Is his groin good after he sat out against Memphis and missed the majority of that tournament semifinal game against Cincy? And granted, this was a team that I think spent a not significant, insignificant amount of this season as the ranked number one team, a deserving one seed, but I think there's still a different kind of pressure when you're one loss away from your season ending. And it just didn't really feel like things were breaking your way in real time. You saw even before he left and didn't come back, Marcus Sasser kind of struggled to get going, and after he hit his second shot of the game, almost immediately going to the bench wincing, did not return while clearly icing and treating his previously injured groin. I think that wasn't what any of us wanted to see in the first half of that game. You never really saw the Cougars able to get the outside shooting on track, I think, save for a couple of very timely Emmanuel Sharp three-pointers. And I thought the Norse did a really good job in the two specific areas that I think we isolated when we previewed them as their strongest, that they did a really good job forcing Cougar turnovers, did a really good job getting second chances and grabbing offensive boards. And the Thursday was the Cougs' second worst turnover percentage game to date in the current season, was bottom 10 an opponent offensive rebounding percentage allowed, that you were able to do that and still come away with a double-digit win. I think now, after the Auburn game, I think now with a little perspective, I didn't enjoy any of the round of 64 game against Northern Kentucky in real time, but I kind of looked back at the box score as I put together my thoughts this episode and thought, wow, I can't believe we won this game by 11 and held a lead of some kind for a decent chunk of regulation. And I think you saw what the Norse couldn't overcome was the fact that they didn't really have any other guys besides Sam Vinson who were consistently putting the ball in the basket. Even Vinson didn't do very well shooting from beyond the arc. That Marcus Warwick, their go-to guy offensively down the stretch of the season, was 2 of 18 from the field, was held to single digits for only the second time since the calendar turned to 2023. I think that helped the Cougars a lot. And I think individually, you got to start, I think, in terms of those performances with Jairus Walker and Wani Roberts. I think those guys deserve a lot of credit. Roberts was the only guy who really gave you consistent presence in the offensive glass, and I think Walker gave you a number of timely buckets and an overall efficient offensive performance when you desperately needed someone to give you that. I think, like a number of times this season when the Cougs have really needed it, Jairus Walker came up clutch, but doesn't get more clutch than what Emmanuel Sharp gave you in 22 minutes on Thursday. I want to go back to this moment. Northern Kentucky had cut the Cougs' lead back to 41-38, just under, I think it was just after, the under 12 media timeout, and back-to-back possessions, Emmanuel Sharp drained three-pointers to get the Cougar lead out to 9 points, and that wasn't an insurmountable lead, and that wasn't the last time you saw Northern Kentucky make it interesting, but if you want to talk about inflection points of this game, those two Emmanuel Sharp threes, I think for me, I'm not going to say it was the last point I was nervous in that game, because they cut to 5 points a couple different times down the stretch, but I think that's when I kind of got it out of my mind that, oh no, are we about to be the second team to get a 16 seed upsetting us?
Yeah, you kind of hit on a lot of the highlights there. It is a game that you kind of look back and you go, man, how did we win this one? You know, you had Marcus going out, lackluster team performance that led to Coach Sampson afterwards saying that Juwan Roberts was the only player that really played with the right attitude and commitment. You know, the uncharacteristic 17 team turnovers, the uncharacteristic negative 11 in second chance points, 4 of 16 shooting from beyond the arc. It's just like, what did we do well enough to win that game? I'm not really sure. One of the main reasons Houston did advance was that Northern Kentucky shot an even worse percentage from deep than the Cougs did, and they just kept jacking those shots up. They were 5 of 33, 15% from beyond the arc as a team. You mentioned Warwick, 2 of 18 from the floor, 1 of 8 from beyond the arc. Yeah, very happy to have won the game. Very happy that Marcus seems to be on the mend and capable of playing going forward. Said he was going to be 90 to 100% for the Miami game. And certainly Houston's team defense deserves at least some of the credit for how poorly NKU shot the ball. But yeah, man, it's a little scary to think that the Cougs were like one player on NKU having a hot shooting night away from maybe beating Purdue to the punch of being the second one seed to lose in the first round. Which, I mean, honestly, not to go on too much of a tangent here, but you know, I really thought this year, I already kind of thought it, and this year I think really convinced me that just like 16s beating ones is just not going to be the seemingly impossible thing that it used to be. The overall talent pool in college basketball in terms of players and the overall talent pool in college basketball in terms of coaches, I think, is just growing every year and getting larger than they have ever been. You know, we've had three straight years now of a 15 beating a 2 as well, which I think just tells you that there are so many teams and so many conferences that are playing good basketball right now that just the quality of the 16 seed is higher than it's ever been. Especially if you have a year like this year where, you know, there weren't too many just like singularly dominant teams in college basketball. There wasn't kind of, you know, this was one of the big storylines, not really the big one, you know, dominant whatever, which, you know, as a Houston fan, I resent a little bit because I think we were pretty darn good. But, you know, I mean, even we shot, you know, lost a Temple at some point during the regular season, which is not a super ridiculously far comp from what a type of 16 type seed is what you're going to face in the first round. So I really don't think it's going to be an impossible thing the way it used to be considered that, but glad to have not you know, fallen victim to that. Agree with Coach Sampson about Wani Roberts, by the way, being the kind of the driving force in this one. 11 points, 12 boards, including 5 on the offensive end, 4 assists with just 1 turnover. You know, was the AAC most improved player of the year for a damn good reason. And, you know, there have been a bunch of games this year that you and I have come back after the worst and said, you know, if Wani hadn't taken such a big step forward this offseason, Houston probably doesn't win that game. And I think this game falls into that category. So you mentioned, you know, Jairus Walker, not his strongest game, I don't think, overall, but did assert himself offensively inside against a smaller opponent. Game high 16 points on 6 of 8 shooting. You mentioned Manuel Sharp coming up big with those threes in the second half. You know, Jamal Shedd, uncharacteristic 6 turnovers while fighting through a hyperextended knee, but still managed to score 13 with 6 assists. So, you know, not a game I don't think we're going to look back on too fondly. It might be a game we try not to look back on too much at all. But, you know, to win any game in the NCAA tournament, you got to do some stuff right. And obviously glad we saw just enough in terms of positive performances from the Cougs in this one to advance.
No doubt. And I would say for the next one, Dustin, that game against Auburn, that was one of the most tale of two halves kind of games that we've talked about, whether regular season or postseason, with regards to this program in a good long while. I think all of us, present company definitely included, after that first 20 minutes of basketball, I think we would have taken any kind of win by any margin. That the Cougars ended up winning this one by double digits and pulled away while having to sit both Marcus Sasser and Jamal Shedd with 4 fouls. I've talked about it. I've watched that second half a couple different times now. I've written a fair amount about it in my notes, so I've kind of relived it that way. It still doesn't feel real. It's still, I don't think in any universe I expected when I sat down to start watching the second half of that game that it would be a 17-point Cougar win that went off the exact way it happened. And I will say, the Cougs did lead for a decent chunk of the first half, but you saw in the last 7 or 8 minutes of that opening half, quite honestly, at times it looked like Auburn was playing a different sport. They weren't just making a lot of their shots, but I think what made that first half so scary is how easy the looks Auburn got were. I mean, it's one thing to face an opponent who's hitting all their shots, and you can kind of look at that and say to yourself, well, they're going to cool down at some point. And the Tigers definitely hit some tough shots in that first half surge, but a lot of what Auburn was doing, it kind of, not to go cross sports with my metaphors here, but it kind of felt akin to an opponent of football, and that opponent's just consistently getting 7 or 8 yards rushing against you, that no matter what you're trying to do, they're getting something that looks easy every time they want it. You saw on the offensive end also, in addition to that, I think uncharacteristic defensive performance, the Cougars really struggled badly to create good looks. They barely made half of their free throws in that opening half, and it just really felt like everything was working against you in real time. You're playing in as close to a road environment as you're probably going to get in the tournament. You're not shooting the ball well. You're not defending well. Just felt really bad all around. And I think we all knew the first handful of minutes in that second half was going to be telling that, you know, what the Cougars would look like. I think it was kind of the tell of, okay, should I start making my peace mentally with the season, or is this team going to look like a dramatically different team than the one we saw the first 20 minutes? And very quickly, the Cougars cut into that 10-point halftime lead. I think you even saw Bruce Pearl at halftime even say, like, yeah, we're leading by a lot, but I don't expect this to be the norm for 40 minutes of basketball against this Houston team. And I think he probably wishes he was a little bit less right about that one. But I think we saw as emphatic of a response out of the locker room as we've seen from this team this year. And I'll let you get into the how it happened to really enjoy reliving that, Dustin, but as good of a second half as we've seen from Cougar men's basketball, regardless of the year, in a long, long time.
Yeah, I think part of what made that 10-point halftime deficit so scary, because I mean, certainly we knew and we've known all year that this Houston team is capable of coming back from a 10-point deficit, was that it kind of made sense for the way that the game was going on. You know, against Northern Kentucky, I think my thought process going in was like, hey, you know, I don't care how banged up we are, I just have a hard time believing this team is going to lose to Northern Kentucky, you know, where you go to all of a sudden you're facing an Auburn team that is in Birmingham, you know, with a home court advantage. You know, you're clearly significantly less than 100% as a team. You know, it just suddenly felt very much like a game that it just wouldn't be that surprising or even a, you know, I mean, Houston was only like a 5.5-point favorite, I think, in this one from what I saw. So just wouldn't have been that surprising to not get through. And the first half kind of went the way that the paranoid version of my brain was worried that it would. Just a back and forth with neither team really getting separation. And when a team finally did make a run, it was Auburn. Pushed that lead to double digits. Houston looked like maybe they just weren't healthy enough to catch up. But kind of like you mentioned, the second half had a very different script. Houston came out looking like a very completely different team on defense. Would end up holding Auburn to just 4 made field goals after halftime, which is hard to believe given, like you mentioned, what an easy time the Tigers were getting good looks in the first half. Tremont Mark opened the second half scoring with the layup, and then Jarris hit a 3, and just like that, less than 90 seconds in, all of a sudden a 10-point lead is a 5-point lead, which very immediately makes it feel like a very different game. And the Cougs were able to keep going from there, turn it into a back and forth game with the lead changing hands, but then, you know, Marcus Sasser, like you said, picked up his 4th foul at the 10:53 mark. Jamal Shedd picked up his 4th a couple minutes later at the 8:22 mark, and as a result of the Shedd foul, KD Johnson got 2 free throws, which he split, which made it a 3-point Houston lead at that point. They'd done a remarkable job to turn that 10-point halftime deficit into a 3-point lead. But nonetheless, with those guys going out, I remember thinking at the time, you're going to have 2 freshman guards out there for an extended period. You know, I just hope Houston can, like, keep this, like, even. You know, can you... Whenever, you know, whether it's 4 or 5 minutes left in the game, whenever, you know, Samson feels comfortable putting Shedd and Sasser back on the court, you know, just at least keep it, like, tied so that you're not having to, like, to make up a deficit. And Houston did very much better than that. They continued playing fantastic defense, and then Tremont Mark just took this game over offensively. The entire team played well, to be clear, and we'll give out, you know, some more deserved kudos to some other players here in a bit, but the stretch of basketball played by Tremont Mark in the second half, especially after Sasser and Shedd went out, I tweeted, it'll go down in Cougar lore. It's one that we're going to be talking about for years and years and years to come. That is as big time as it gets. You know, Mark's a terrific player. The only criticism I think that maybe you could lob at him at times is that he sometimes, you know, sinks into the background a little bit too much when Houston needs him to step up. Only had 10 points in the loss to Memphis with Sasser out. Only had 4 against Northern Kentucky with Sasser missing most of that one. And then he turns around and just plays one of the most sublime halves of basketball you're ever going to see with Houston's season on the line. By the time that Sasser and Shedd came back in at the under 4 media timeout, Houston had not only maintained the lead, they had increased it by 10 points from 3 to 13. A friend of the pod, Jeremy Branham, had this on Twitter, was the first person that I saw with this factoid. After Marcus Sasser picked up his 4th foul, from the rest of the game on, Tremont Mark single-handedly outscored Auburn 18-16. Just ridiculous. Just grabbed finished with a career-high 26 points with just 1 turnover while he's pouring in all those points. Grabbed 9 boards to narrowly miss the double-double. Yeah, there's like I said, there's lots of other things that you can talk about for this game, but that second half from Tremont Mark is the one where I don't know how much you can talk about it because words just kind of fail to describe how dominant he was, how good he was at getting his shot, and then just how consistently he made all those shots. Just remarkable, and something that, you know, halftime was worried. Sasser going out was worried. Shedd going out was worried, and it didn't matter because Tremont Mark was like, it's okay, I got this. I am putting this team on my shoulder and carrying us to the next round.
I texted a friend of the, and sometimes co-host of the show, Bobby, in real time. I went and found my text message. I just texted him, let's just try and get Sasser in around 5 or 6 minutes and the game still be close. And I guess we failed in that regard because the game wasn't close, but that was because of the otherworldly, transcendent, all the things you said, the Tremont Mark performance. Incredible. I think words fail there. I think this is a guy who's come up big in some big moments. We're talking about that the half-court shot he hit to beat Memphis in the 2021 regular season finale in the tournament against Rutgers, getting that absurd tip-in where he started around the three-point line and somehow was able to get into a crowded paint and tip what ended up being the basket that put the Cougars ahead for good in a really difficult round of 32 game that we talked about a little bit here at the top. But I thought on a team level, the, you know, Cougars, I think you would look at the box score and you'd assume what the Cougars did with Jahni Broome, Auburn's good big man, you'd kind of assume that UMH did a hack-a-Shaq strategy. And I don't believe that this was a deliberate, I guess, hack-a-Broome strategy so much as UMH played Broome a lot more physically, and the end result was that you got a below-average free throw shooter making a ton of trips to the line. And Auburn did a good job getting to the charity stripe, but I think the fact that they were a below-average free-throw shooting team for the balance of the season really caught up with them, and those 10 missed freebies from Broome were the most glaring, but guys like KD Johnson, Zepp Jasper, and Trey Donaldson, Auburn guards, combined to go 6 of 11 also from the charity stripe. I think that was also part of the pain. And on the flip side, after shooting so badly on your freebies in the first half, the Cougars were perfect in the second half. And the first half didn't really reflect it, but this is a team that's really shot better from the free throw line, this Cougar team, in the back half of the current season. We saw in your two regular season losses to Bama and then to Temple that the Cougars' free throw shooting failed them some pretty key moments. But I think this was a team we always thought would be better at the charity stripe than maybe some of the earlier season performances reflected. So it's really good in the postseason where your margins are a lot slimmer and the stakes are a lot higher that you've seen this team do such a better job at the charity stripe. And much as we were all feeling the positive momentum, you know, the Cougars turning that 10-point deficit into a 2-point deficit in less than 4 minutes of game time in the second half. I mean, I think we were all pretty nervous when Sasser and then Shedd around the 10 and 8 minute marks both had to go to the bench with four fouls. But, you know, by that point, even with Tremont Mark and two freshmen being your guards, you were already seeing Mark have a good game. And he's such a rhythm player that I think you kind of know about 7 or 8 minutes in to a Tremont Mark game whether this is going to be one where he's feeling it offensively or just it's not happening for him on that end. I think the Northern Kentucky game would probably be kind of in that latter category, even though I think he did a good job defensively. And it can be frustrating in the games where he's not feeling it, but you're also going to have games like Saturday where he shows, Tremont Mark does, why he was one of the very best Texas high school basketball players, why he was one of this program's biggest recruits in the modern era. And he was just so good in those decisive minutes of the second half that you never really needed Sasser or Shedd to come back in and save the day, though I think it was nice to see Sasser put an exclamation point on what had been, I think, a very good performance, 5 of 9 from deep, and certainly, I think, put any thoughts that he wasn't ready physically to play for this game to the side and made them look very silly. I thought it was a nice exclamation point, though. He had that corner three inside of 2 minutes left, I think well and truly put the game on ice, but and you saw during that stretch where Shedd and Sasser were out, Tremont Mark become, I think in a lot of ways, your primary ball handler. And that was something he did as a prep player back at Dickinson High School, but maybe not something he's really had to do much in college, playing with guys like Deke Jerome Shedd as the point guard, also having a guy like Sasser, who I think can also be a functional secondary ball handler out there. And I think what makes him so unique, Mark, among the guards in this roster is that he's so much more of a natural at breaking guys down one-on-one and driving to the hole. Not that Marcus Sasser can't do that. Not that Jamal Shedd can't do that. But I think Mark is just so much more of a natural in that area. Or he could drive and pull back for a mid-range jumper. I think he really has that lost art down there. That from Shedd subbing out at 8:22 left through the end of the game, Mark had 12 points and was a perfect 8 of 8 from the charity stripe. That 26.9 rebound performance, like you said, I mean, just Auburn just did not have anyone who could stay in front of Tremont Mark, and I think that bore itself out pretty decisively in the second half. I wanted to point this one out. I don't think it was probably something we thought much about. I thought Wani Roberts hitting a pair of free throws to extend the Cougar lead to 7 points might not be something we remember, but it felt really important in real time. It felt like the start of U of H pulling away and being up by more than a basket or two. And I wanted to also single out Jairus Walker because 7 points, I don't think, tells you his full impact. And obviously, ditto for Robertson, his 6 points. And the most obvious thing is those two guys combining for 11 blocks that's going to jump out at you from the box score. And after Auburn basically got anything it wanted offensively in the paint in the first half, I think that you just saw it change so dramatically after halftime. The Tigers got their shots blocked so often, and I think you could start to see those blocked shots really affect their confidence, their willingness to go inside. It made this opponent who Auburn has really been kind of hot or cold, really struggle to put the ball in the basket at times. You saw them start to settle for jumpers. But back to Walker, I think if I was an NBA scout or evaluator and I was watching on Saturday night, I'd be really intrigued by what I saw because we all saw, you know, a guy who was an unbelievable athlete. We saw a guy who impacted winning in ways outside of just putting the ball in the basket. Obviously, the shot blocking, but you saw a guy who's also a well above average rebounder and a guy who can make the kind of plays that you don't expect a 6'8" freshman who's built like a tank to make. And I think there's no better example of that than that fast break he ran where he dished the ball off at just the most perfect moment to Reggie Chaney. Chaney gets the layup. Cougars extend the lead to double digits for the first time in the game. And I'm not saying Jairus Walker is the only 6'8" guy who can run a fast break in Division I, but I also think you're not going to see very many guys who can make the play with the body control and precision that Walker showed. And I think just kind of Saturday's display of what you've seen all year if you're a Cougar fan from Walker. He's an unbelievably skilled big man who could score at all three levels, is a plus rebounder, shot blocker, and defender, but he also doesn't have the five-star ego. He's a guy that when he's having an off night offensively, or you know, one of his other very skilled teammates like Jerron Mark is having a really good night, he's not going to be a guy who's going to have an ego about getting the basketball. And I thought, obviously, Jerron Mark's the headline individual performance, but as I reflect on this game a lot, I think what Walker gave you on Saturday night was so, so valuable.
Yeah, Walker, really impressive. And yeah, you just mentioned the 11 blocks between him and Wani Roberts. The 6 for Jairus is a new U of H NCAA tournament single game record, which is pretty remarkable given one Mr. Olajuwon that used to play here who was not too bad at blocking the shots himself. And yeah, it was an Auburn team that, you know, didn't want to bomb it from outside. They wanted to get into the lane, and they did. They got 30 points in the paint in this one. They got to the line 36 times. But like you mentioned, Walker and Roberts made their lives uncomfortable. They made them earn those points where they did get them, made them kind of rethink their strategy in the second half. And fortunately, those 36 free throw attempts by Auburn didn't hurt Houston that badly, because Auburn made just 19 of them. Houston, meanwhile, like you mentioned, not only perfect for in the second half, perfect on 18 attempts in the second half, which 18 of 18 from the free throw line is going to make any coach happy. And seeing that free throw shooting be an X factor in Houston's favor in what was a close game most of the way was just delightful. And yeah, Marcus Asser playing in this one, obviously, good to see him out there. I think it was still pretty clear he wasn't at 100%, but, you know, it's a remarkable statement on the kind of player he is that a less than 100% Marcus can still score 22 points on 7 of 14 with just one turnover, which was part of Houston as a team committing just 7 turnovers in the game after committing 17 in the first round. So just an impressive as hell performance all around. Great Houston, great on the glass, great at the free throw line, great at taking care of the ball. Had just every reason to freak out and fold, playing banged up in a hostile environment with Auburn coming out in the first half with, you know, four out of five Cougar starters eventually picking up 4 fouls. You know, didn't matter. Houston made it clear in the second half who the superior team was, and that's why they'll advance to face Miami on Friday. And the Cougs in this one will be taking on the Hurricanes. Miami in the back in the NCAA tournament for the second weekend, once again for the second straight year after a surprise run to the Elite Eight last year as a 10 seed. The Hurricanes this time around advanced to the Sweet 16 with wins over Drake and Indiana. The latter game denied the world would have been a salty as hell matchup between Kelvin Sampson and the Indiana Hoosiers. And despite that game being technically a 5-over-4, you know, upset, so to speak, you know, you and I, Sam, have talked about this offline. We both agree that Miami is the tougher matchup overall. They're the deeper team. And it's a Miami team that's been playing its best basketball of the year down the stretch. They've been really good offensively all year. Out of their last 13 games, the Drake game was the only one of those that they scored fewer than a point per possession. They got 4 players averaging better than 13 points a game. And the thing that's scary about them offensively is just that they do pretty much everything well. They shoot the threes well. They get inside well. They have a nice balance between twos and threes. They're top 20 nationally in free throw shooting percentage. They take care of the ball. They hit the offensive glass. And they've got the depth. Like they said, 4 guys averaging better than 13 points. Leading scorer Isaiah Wong in his 4th year in Coral Gables. The other 3 are all transfers. Jordan Miller came in 2 years ago from George Mason. And then Larinaga hit really 2 home runs in the portal this offseason, bringing in guard Nigel Peck from Kansas State and forward Norchad Omir from Arkansas State, Sam. So, you know, certainly we'll get into some ways here in a little bit in terms of ways that, you know, I think that there are, you know, weaknesses and things that you can exploit with this Miami team. But just looking at how much talent they have offensively, how much they do well, you know, this is a Houston might not be able to afford to have as bad of a defensive performance as they did in the first half against Auburn, because, man, Miami's might be in the 50s or something if Houston plays that bad, because this team can score the basketball and can do it in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, Miami wants to do the things that Auburn did successfully in that first half, but unlike Auburn, you can't fall back on the okay, but they've been a bad shooting team most of the year. There's no way they would keep that up for 40 minutes. No, Miami is quite a good shooting team. They're just about as good as any offensive team we've seen in the current season. I wanted to start with one of the guys you mentioned, Norchad Omir. The first ever player from Nicaragua to play Division I hoops, actually played at a prep school in Miami, so at least an American homecoming of sorts after he played his first 2 seasons at Arkansas State, where he was a great rebounder and efficient scorer on some not very good A-State teams. And Miami made kind of an out-of-nowhere Sweet 16, or excuse me, Elite Eight run last year, had some deep-pocketed NIL efforts from one John Ruiz that helped land Omir, and also another guy we'll probably mention, Nigel Pack from K-State. Omir really no problem on his part making the jump from the Sun Belt to the ACC. Has averaged a double-double this year, just over 13 points and 10 boards. Is just barely outside the national top 100 in offensive rebounding percentage. So not really a guy who's going to shoot from deep often, but a really efficient low post scorer and a guy with enough range that you have to respect him outside of 10 feet, a guy who's also really good at getting to the free throw line. And I think any big man who's shooting 72%, I think you're going to take that any day of the week. Has 31 rebounds so far in two NCAA tournament games. I think an absurd number without any context, but I think you add on the fact that Omir is not at 100% health right now, and there were some pretty serious questions about whether or not he would even be healthy for the tournament's first weekend, and just absolutely balled out against Drake and Indiana. Had a little bit of foul trouble against the Hoosiers, but you could really see when he was able to be on the court in the second half against Indiana that just there was no way Indiana was going to be checking this Miami team. And that's going to be something to watch, his offensive rebounding, because this is a Cougar team that's obviously great at attacking the offensive glass themselves, but maybe hasn't been the best at times. You've seen some opponents this year have some success crashing the offensive glass against the Cougars, so he's going to be a difficult matchup. Not the biggest guy listed, 6'7", but I think if you've watched enough Cougar basketball, you're well aware that you don't need to have a front court full of 6'10 and 7-foot guys to be a really effective, really pesky offensive rebounding outfit. Another guy I wanted to individually look at, Isaiah Wong, 6'4", junior guard, really going to be a handful for the Cougars to defend. Is a really good free throw shooter, can score at all levels, is reasonably efficient, I think, for the volume that he's asked to shoot the ball. Had a game-high 27 points last time out against Indiana, also had 8 rebounds, and it was also very obvious with Wong, as with Omir, that the Hoosiers really did not have anyone who can consistently stay in front of Wong. And while I would rate the Cougar backcourt a lot more highly than the Hoosiers, that'll still be a challenge for the Cougars. And I wanted to mention one more guy, Jordan Miller, a 6'7", fifth-year guy, transferred in before last season. I believe you mentioned him. Fifth-year guy, another big challenge for the Cougars. Like Wong, I think also really challenged the Hoosiers last time out. Doesn't have the perimeter scoring ability of Wong or Nigel Pack, but still has to be respected from the three-point line and is also an incredibly efficient scorer inside the paint. I've said it probably 4 or 5 times now, but a really efficient scoring team on all levels. They grab offensive boards well. They really don't have an obvious offensive weakness other than the fact that they don't get to the free throw line, I guess, a ton relative to the other ways they score the ball. But this is the number 11 offensive efficiency team in the country per KenPom for a reason. But if you want to talk about weaknesses, I think this is a team that does have some major defensive weaknesses as well. They're good at not sending opponents to the free throw line very often, but that's not really a major part of what U of H has done this year offensively. They're solid on the perimeter, but they're in the bottom third of all Division I teams in opponent 2-point field goal percentage. They don't force a ton of turnovers. I will say what's going to be interesting to watch is the Canes. They don't run tempo as extreme as some of the teams we've seen this year, your Memphises, Bama, maybe Tulane, but I think Miami's going to want to play this game at a bit quicker of a pace than U of H does generally. So that's always something to watch, whether the Cougars style wins out or whether the Canes are able to make the Cougs play a bit quicker, a bit higher possession game than this U of H team is used to.
Yeah, I think if you're talking about weaknesses to exploit, you know, you mentioned that they don't have a ton of size. None of their 5 starters taller than Omir at 6'7". They've got 1 6'9" guy averaging 10 minutes off the bench, but that's about it. And you, like you said, that doesn't stop them from being a good rebounding team, especially on the offensive end. But I think the area where that shows up is that they like you said, they are one of the lower teams in terms of opponents' 2-point field goal shooting. They 51.6% opponents are shooting on 2-pointers, well above the national average. They don't block a ton of shots. Omir actually a pretty good shot blocker for his size, but that's kind of it on the team. Like you said, they're top 25 in terms of not fouling. So it certainly seems like if you can get to the lane, they're probably not going to block your shot, and they're probably not going to foul you. So I think it's going to be a game where it's going to be really really incumbent on Houston to get to the lane, you know, early and often, and to finish once they do get there, and not rely on getting bailed up by foul calls. So, you know, they're pretty much right at the nationwide average in terms of defensive rebounding, forcing turnovers. So this is a team that I think you wouldn't expect Houston to replicate its first round turnover woes again in this game. And it's a team that I think Houston can probably hit the offensive glass against. So that's always a huge X factor with the Kelvin Sampson teams, or really, I guess, any team that's playing basketball is, you know, not only are you making your shots, but how many shots are you getting? Are you getting those extra possessions on offensive rebounds and turnovers? And I feel like this is a game when we're probably going to see both teams taking pretty good care of the ball. And I think we're going to see both teams, you know, getting their second chance points at times. So I think it's going to be real hard for either team to have a major advantage in those kind of bonus possessions categories. But you know, I think if one team or the other can get a slight edge, maybe even a 5 to 10 point edge in terms of looking at those two numbers, I think that could be decisive in a game that feels like it should likely be pretty close.
I want to mention real quick their coach, Jim Larrañaga, may or may not be a familiar name to you. If you remember, George Mason had a crazy run to the Final Four in the 2006 tournament. He was actually George Mason's coach, has been at Miami since the 2011-12 season, during which he's led the Canes to 4 second weekend appearances. This will be their second straight after last year's surprise Elite Eight run. And I thought, really quickly, Larrañaga's resume is interesting, Dustin. It's a good argument for patience if you have an established coach at a program that's maybe not been a historic hoops power, because coming into last season, the Canes were coming off 3 straight losing seasons, 3 straight losing ACC records, and we're coming off before that a first-round exit in the 2018 tournament. So we'll be interesting to watch Larrañaga versus Sampson, two of the most veteran coaches out there. Just really excited to see the Cougars against this Canes team. They're a good offensive team that will really test the Cougars' defensive chops, and I think you're going to see two teams that want to play kind of different styles, and I think that always makes for a compelling basketball game.
All right, and then if the Cougs, we don't want to look too far in advance, but if the Cougs are able to advance with the win against Miami on Friday, they would advance to an Elite Eight matchup on Sunday, which would see them face the winner of the Xavier UT Austin. Of course, we're talking about all the crazy upsets that are going on in this tournament, and of course, Houston's in a region where it's the 1-2-3-5 remaining as you head to the Sweet 16. So, you know, if you're fortunate enough to beat Miami, you're going to face a really, really good team in the Elite Eight, because that describes both Xavier and I'll admit it, the Longhorns in Austin, regardless of who you face. That's a good team. I mean, that's a team that's playing really well right now. Both of those teams, you know, top 15 teams nationally per KenPom, very much deserve to be here. You know, you've seen the Longhorns merge into, you know, kind of late in the year. It's been remarkable that Houston is one of the only teams that's been in the kind of the top 10 or 12 in terms of both offensive and defensive efficiency. You've seen the Longhorns become a top 15 team both sides of the ball. I don't know that there's maybe anybody in the country playing better, hotter basketball than the Longhorns right now. A team that has a lot of different scores that can hurt you. And then Xavier, a team that's kind of pulling the U of H last year, where, you know, they lost Zach Fremantle, one of their stars, but that just hasn't really slowed them down too much. They went through kind of a rough patch in February, but seem to have figured things out and playing really well right now. Another team that's very, very deep and really has a lot of different guys that can hurt you. One of the top 10 offensive team nationally per KenPom. So you're going to get a heck of a test from Miami on Friday. And like I said, if you're fortunate enough, going to be another heck of a test from either of these teams, Sam, in the Elite Eight.
Yeah, Xavier's one of the bigger surprises of the tournament. Like you said, not a surprise they've gotten this far, but maybe a surprise for what the expectations were going into the season, led by first-year head coach making a second stint with the program. Sean Miller took a sabbatical last year after a decade-plus as head coach at Arizona. Was actually Miller, as I alluded to, the Musketeers head coach from 2004 to 2009 prior to taking over at Zona. And I realized that the transfer portal allows for a lot quicker turnarounds than what was previously possible historically, but I think still an incredible job considering that Miller was stepping into a program that had missed the NCAA tournament the past 3 times, not to mention doing this, like you said, without a key guy in Jack Fremantle and also a rotation guy in Kai Tandy. Both guys have been out the last few months. Certainly, if the Cougars see them, they'll be one of the very best offensive teams the Cougars have seen in the current season. So if they win and the Cougars win, your reward for getting past Miami, a really good offensive team, as we've all established, is seeing, I would say, a really, really good Musketeer team in that area. Asole Boom was a really good ad by Sean Miller. I saw a quote from him earlier this season about how even though Boom was moving from UTEP, a Conference USA program, to Xavier, a program I think undebatably in a much tougher league in the Big East, Miller was just so convinced that Boom's ability to get to the line at a lower level would translate, and lo and behold, he's a guy who's one of the best in the country at getting to the line despite transferring up to a much tougher conference. But I think I would co-sign everything you said. It gives me no pleasure to co-sign everything you said, but I'll co-sign everything you said about the Longhorns. They came into the tournament incredibly hot, won the Big 12 championship in Kansas City, only finished one game behind Kansas in the regular season. You probably know the backstory. At the end of last calendar year, second-year head coach Chris Spear was suspended, ultimately fired by the university for domestic violence charges. And since then, Rodney Terry, who had actually previously been a head coach at Fresno and UTEP and was a long, long time Longhorn assistant, both under Beard previously and also longtime head coach Rick Barnes, has taken over as the interim and has done an unimpeachably good job in a really tough spot. 21-7, and I think if this Longhorn team gets past Xavier, I really do think that should be Terry's job next year. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. I think, just getting to the second weekend of the dance, that's not something Shaka Smart ever did. It's not something Chris Beard in his brief time there ever managed. It's not something Rick Barnes could do in his last 7 or 8 years there. And it's a team, this Longhorn team, that has very few obvious weaknesses. It's one of the most veteran rosters in all Division I. It's the oldest team left in the tournament, top 15 nationally right now in both offensive and defensive efficiency. That combining the veteran presence of guys like Marcus Carr, Serge Ibari Rice, Timmy Allen, and Dylan Disu with, you know, the more youthful talent of Tyrese Hunter and Arturo Morris, it's a really good combination. If you want any weaknesses from them, they're not a very good offensive rebounding team, and like the Cougars, they don't get a lot of their points at the free throw line. But that's it. Even with all that said, it'll take an Elite Eight game against an opponent, and I'll be really excited no matter who the Cougars face if they get past the Hurricanes. But who, buddy, Dustin, an Elite Eight showdown, Ants against the Longhorns? I think my heart might stop before tip-off.
Yeah, I've tried not to think too much about it. And I mean, we kind of briefly mentioned it when the brackets came out, like, oh, they got, you know, the top two teams in this region are Houston and UT Austin. How about that? Yeah. Man, one of my personal growth things over the course of my life is that as much as I love sports, and I still do, and I always will, I don't let it affect my emotional mood quite as much. There's no way that us against UT is not going to throw me off emotionally in one of two very different directions after that game is over. So I am kind of secretly praying that that Xavier wins, just because I don't know if I need that much stress and drama in my life. But whew, I don't know. That would be one for the ages. That would get some eyeballs for sure. Would be a fun one.
Yeah, I'm still of two minds. Just in principle, I don't ever want the burnt orange school to win, but oh boy, that would be quite the matchup. Well, like you said, I feel like I've made growth in that area too, but it would be hard not to be on full tilt for basically every moment after that matchup became official until the game.
All right, Sam, you got any last Cougar men's basketball thoughts, or are we going to leave it on that and go talk some women's hoops?
Let's talk some women's hoops, and I wanted to introduce it briefly. We're going to, the two of us tonight, kind of do the tried and true show and tell format. Dustin and I have each to you, I guess that would be the class in this case, the listeners of the class in this it's very mixed metaphor. We're going to bring one Cougar sport each to you tonight. I will be bringing you Cougar women's basketball, who we haven't talked about in a while. Their season just ended, and a fair amount to talk about from the past couple weeks that I think is worth addressing this episode. So I think I'm going to start here with a quick recap from the team's finish to the season. If you'll recall, the Cougars were a 4 seed going into the American Championship in Fort Worth, and they opened up in the 4-5 game against SMU, had a really nice close to that head-to-head, played suffocating defense, and played the kind of defense the Cougars really showed at a high level down the stretch in conference play, beat the Ponies 52-33 in two different quarters. I thought this was really cool. Held SMU to two field goals and under 20% shooting. And right before the Cougs actually took the court, you had a pretty seismic upset on the Cougar side of the bracket. 8-seed Wichita State decisively took down USF, who'd previously only lost to the Cougars in conference play, had gone 17-1 in the American regular season, was the conference's really sole team that had an at-large resume. It did ultimately still make the field of 64 because of said unimpeachable resume, but even though you'd seen this Cougar team beat the Bulls previously and the other one had been a close loss in Houston, getting the one seed out of the tournament felt in real time like a big, big deal, and it allowed us the hope that U of H could maybe make a run and get that auto bid. And that hope didn't diminish after a back-and-forth semifinal win over the plucky 8 seed Shockers. The Cougars and Shockers traded leads, played extremely close before the Cougs pulled away late for a 72-64 semifinal win, made the first conference championship game appearance since Ron Huey's taken over here. Tiara Young's 26 points off the bench, I think, should go down as one of the better single-game performances in recent program history. Also helped out by double-digit scoring efforts from Layla Blair and Britt Onyeje, and the Cougars would get in the finals a rematch with ECU, a defensive-minded opponent, an opponent who not that long previously had handed the Cougars a painful triple overtime road loss where U of H blew some big leads late on the road in Greenville. And the finals got off to a really good start. You saw the Cougars hold the Pirates to 2 points and just a microscopic 1-of-17 shooting in the first quarter. And when I kind of look back on that first quarter, it feels more like a missed opportunity. The Cougars also shot under 30% in that quarter. And I don't know, maybe if you come out of the gate shooting closer to 50%, maybe if it's a 25-2 kind of margin after that quarter as opposed to 11-2, I don't know, maybe you break ECU's spirit such that they're not able to make the comeback and they're not able to really think about being in the same headspace that they probably were, which was after a quarter, like, hey, we played absolutely awful and we're still only down single digits. And the Cougars didn't do badly in the second quarter. You did start to see ECU find a bit of rhythm offensively, but Cougs still went to the half with a 7-point lead. Unfortunately, you could start to see the cracks forming. ECU never at any point allowed U of H to make anything happen outside the arc, even the inside scoring. I didn't see it very often. When Tatiana Hill and Cameron Jones got the ball, they were effective, but ECU did a very, very good job denying the ball or making the Cougars take outside shots that just the Cougs just could not hit at all. Layla Blair and Britt Onyeje unfortunately combined to go 1-of-17 from the field, and if you were going to win this game, you just couldn't have that happen and also have a realistic chance to win. But still, ECU erased most of the lead in the third quarter. It was an extremely close fourth. ECU took the lead for good inside of 2 minutes, and even with that, U of H still had the ball down 45-44, but Bria Patterson missed a layup, and that was all she wrote. ECU won the game and captured the American's auto bid, made their return to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2007 for that program. Dustin, really kind of felt like that loss in the finals was the same song and dance we've talked about this team and some of their really heartbreaking conference losses this year.
Yeah, it was tough. This has been a team that that all year long has kind of done the, like, you know, after the kind of disastrous 3-10 non-conference, you go, okay, I'm kind of giving up on the year, and then they would play just well enough to, against some good teams, to like get you back in and have some disappointing losses, but just well enough to get you back in, have some disappointing losses. And they did manage to do it one more time in the conference tournament, where they got the couple of victories, were obviously helped out, like you mentioned, by USF going down and not having to face the Bulls for a third time. Not that they, you know, they fared pretty well the first two times, but would still rather not have to face them again. And then, yeah, you get what seems like a pretty beatable ECU team in the conference championship game, an ECU team that was just as much of a neophyte to the AAC championship game, had just as little experience being in that kind of stage as Houston did, trying to finally break the juju, get Ron Huey to the NCAA tournament for the first time in year nine, leading the program. And you just, yeah, you had so many of the same issues, the just not being able to get quality shots with any regularity, and just seeing a lot of the same things, and just not being able to finish out games, and just saw a lot of that creep up. So yeah, I don't know. I kind of wish I could go back and just tell 3-10, you know, the Dustin that was watching this 3-10 team, and it's like, yeah, no matter what happens, don't get your hopes too up, because they're definitely, for a moment there, I was like, oh man, we're gonna actually do it. We're not really going through the front door with a team that is, you know, at large worthy and doesn't need to win the conference tournament in a surprise, you know, to get in. But we could, you know, 2010 U of H men's basketball this and kind of sneak in with not the best team that we've had in the last handful of years, which is funny. That's because you look back, I mean, that what the 2010 team was not Houston's best team under Tom Penders, but it was the one that they got to the NCAA tournament. And this has not been Houston's best team under Ron Huey. Unfortunately, This was not only was it not the best team, it also wasn't the one that got him to the NCAA tournament.
So, despite having what I would say, the Cougars, for the faults of the season, for all the stuff you laid out there, I would say the team definitely had a WNIT caliber resume. I think that was evidenced by the fact that you saw SMU, Tulane, and Memphis get invites, but unfortunately, those non-conference struggles you alluded to bit them and couldn't get an invite because of the below 500 overall record, and the season ended with that frustrating Thursday night loss in Fort Worth. But as of right now, we have no official confirmation, but we haven't seen any movement in terms of U of H moving on from ninth-year head coach Ronald Huey. And I don't think this is an ironclad indicator, but on Monday, Bria Patterson, who did participate in Senior Day, announced that she would be using her fifth season because of the COVID eligibility freeze to return to the Cougar program, which, again, not an ironclad assurance, but I think to me seems like an indicator that the staff that she's played for and was recruited by will be back. Layla Blair, your leading scorer, is a junior, should be back. Two of your other starters, Britt Onyeche and Tatiana Hill, were fifth-year players and will be out of eligibility. But we'll say those are the only two rotation players or starters that will be out of eligibility. Everyone else projects to return, including Cameron Jones, the only other remaining starter I have not mentioned. And I will say the really intriguing name for me to watch will be Tara Young, who she walked on senior night and is in her fourth college season. So like Patterson has the ability to play another year because of the COVID eligibility freeze, but I've not seen anything official there one way or the other. And I'm not going to pound on the table tonight and demand Ron Huey get fired, because I think I've reached the age where I know what it's like to get laid off. I know what it's like to live every day waking up and wondering if all the blood, sweat, and tears you put into something would be for naught, and that you would wake up one day without the job that you've had for a number of years. And I don't wish that existence on even people I don't particularly like, and I wouldn't say that's Ronald Huey at all. I think he's a great representative of the university. But I will say, this year, even with some of the highlights, even with the team getting heartbreakingly close to the NCAA postseason, you had a roster I think that was capable of doing a lot better than 15-16 overall and being the four seed in a conference that really only had one at-large caliber team. And it's great you beat that one at-large caliber team in the regular season. It's great that you got close to the NCAA tournament, but you had the ability to do more. And losing five very close games in conference that you had the chance to win, that hurts in non-conference. I think you lost a couple of games at the start of the year to Ulala in New Mexico that you had no business losing to. You had a chance for some signature wins. The two Florida schools, Florida and Florida State, even Portland would have been a nice win considering they ended up making the NCAAs, but you let those potential wins slip through your fingers, and it kind of feels like a missed opportunity of the season. It wasn't Huey's best team, but I feel like in some areas, certainly the defensive areas, they had the potential to be the best team, and you're going to now go into a drastically tougher set of opponents next year, the Big 12. And I realize that any coach, whether it's Ronald Huey or a hypothetical other coach, would struggle in the new league in year one, but I don't know, man. It's hard not to feel a little bit more apathy if the U of H athletics administration thinks that a sub 500 season with this veteran of a team is good enough. And again, I'm not going to pound on the table and demand Ron Huey's fired, but I think the results were frustrating given what we saw this team be capable of at times this year in flashes.
Yeah, I don't want to, again, I'm right there with you. I don't want to call for Ron Huey's fired because I like him a lot. He's been on the podcast and he was awesome, and I love his energy and I love him as a representative of this university. And you know, when you talk about struggling programs, you know, it's you've not seen the mass exodus after a tough season of transfers, and you see a Brad Patterson, you know, wanting to come back and play her fifth year for Huey. It certainly seems like is the indication there. Yeah, I mean, 9 years, and you know, to be fair, you would want to acknowledge that he took over a program that was struggling mightily. But even if you give the guy, you know, give him a year zero, give him 2 year zeros, that's 7 years of not making the NCAA tournament. And yeah, you could say a couple of years ago they were the first team out, and you know, I would argue that they deserve to be in. But you know, and then certainly, you know, things could have gone a little bit differently versus East Carolina, and you could have gotten a you could have gotten a bid this year. But regardless of kind of the, you know, individual decisions by, you know, selection committees or the, you know, individual, you know, conference championship, how the bounces go in a single game, you know, you give a coach enough time to kind of figure out what their level is, and then you determine if that level is good enough. And Coach Huey's level is NIT team. You know, maybe this is, he prior to this year, like I said, they went to, well, I think what, four straight NITs, and like you said, even, you know, they had the net rating to be in the NIT had they not played a tough non conference schedule. They got their record below 500. So this is, you know, I think quality wise, it's another, you know, it could be a very well an NIT team as well. But you know, it's an NIT team that maybe occasionally is gonna bump up and you know, like I said, 2 years ago maybe they would have been the best. Maybe they would have been one of the last few teams into the field as an at large. Like, would that really change though your overall view of what the level is that Coach Huey is capable of taking this program to? Because it doesn't seem like it. And you can certainly argue that, okay, well, you know, he's at the NIT level now, but he's, you know, with going to the Big 12 and getting the resources that the Big 12 has, that you're able to then, you know, that you're able to raise your level because of the other resources that are available to you. And certainly that, you know, I think there's an argument there, but you know, just looking at what the Florida schools were able to do, and obviously UCF kind of fell off of a cliff this year. But looking at what the Florida schools were able to do consistently in the American, you know, Houston just wasn't able to get to that level. He was just, his level that he was able to get Houston to in the American was not similar to even the level that the UCF and USFs of the world were able to get their programs to in the American, even giving him several years to get there. So I don't know. I just have a hard time accepting that if Huey comes back next year, which it looks like he will, and if Houston doesn't go to the NCAA tournament next year, which I don't think they will, because I think they're going to struggle in the Big 12. And you know, and hurt, you know, hopefully you get Layla Blair and Bria Patterson back, but clearly missing some players as well. I mean, you're going to give one coach a decade of not going to the NCAA tournament without making a move. That just seems like too long. I don't know how you can give one decade of your program's history to one coach who just hasn't gotten you to the place that you'd think any and you know, any team that U of H sponsors, your eventual goal is at least getting to the NCAA tournament semi regularly. So I don't know. It's going to be a little bit frustrating, and obviously, like I said, like him a lot. So if that's the decision, he's back next year. No one will be cheering more for Ronald Huey to make us both look very foolish forever doubting him than I will be. But, you know, just standing here on March 21st, or sitting here, I should say, I'm not going to lie, pretend like I'm podcasting standing up, but sitting here on March 21st, it seems hard to justify bringing him back for another season.
Yeah, can't disagree with any of that. All right, Dustin, tell the class what you brought for your Cougar Sports Show and Tell today.
All right, for Cougar Sports Show and Tell, I brought the Cougar... I don't know if it's golfs or golves. Is it golves when you pluralize golf? I don't know. I was pondering
I'm gonna
this the entire
Bobby
time.
Right now, and see if we can get an answer before the episode's up. But we're gonna say golves. I want it to be a thing with a V, so we're gonna say golves.
So I'll talk about the Houston Cougar golves. But the women's golf program has had kind of a bit of a bumpy ride. Both of these programs, I should mention up top, you have your kind of bifurcated season between the fall campaign, and then you take a break, and then you come back for the spring campaign, and we're now well underway of the spring campaign. Both the men's and women's teams have competed in four events in the spring season, have a little while to go here before we get to... AAC championships kind of in the latter half of next month. But start with the women's team. Been a bit of a bumpy ride as they've gotten back under the way in the spring season. They opened up with a fourth place finish in the San Diego State Classic, which is a pretty respectable result. But unfortunately, they tumbled at the Icon Invitational hosted right near home in Humble. The Cougs finished 15th among 16 teams. And while all but a few of those teams were ranked in the top 40, so it's not a season-ending result or anything like that, it did send the Cougs tumbling in the team rankings from borderline top 25 to down in the 40s. But the Cougs have responded well. In their next event, the Trinity Forest Invitational up in Dallas, they finished second as a team ahead of top 50 teams in Tulsa and Kent State. And more recently, this past weekend, they competed at the Mountain View Collegiate in Arizona. They tied for fourth. They actually tied with a top 10 San Jose State team ahead of a bunch of top 40 to 50 teams. So very strong result there for the Cougs. Houston was up to 36 in the golf stat team rankings prior to that tournament. They hadn't updated the rankings yet when I checked today, but I would expect to see that ranking continue to go up. And, you know, I think it's been encouraging, despite that kind of one pretty bad result. I think it's been encouraging this spring to see a number of different Cougs posting strong performances. The Cougs, actually, in their most recent event, the Mountain View Collegiate had a round where all five of their competitors shot subpar rounds in the same round, something that had never been done in school history prior to that. In the fall season, you know, we were so wowed by the freshmen, but it's been really exciting to see some veterans in Annie Kim and Nicole Abelard playing really well. They led the way in Arizona this past weekend for the Cougs. So excited to see this Cougs team rebounding from that that 15th place finish, Sam. And like I said, one of the things we were kind of asking for in the fall season was for it to be a more complete team performance and not just a couple of freshmen leading the way. And I think we're finally starting to see that, where you might have, you know, all five of your golfers playing real well at the same time, hopefully.
Yeah, as much as the freshman performances from the fall were and are exciting, they are things that I think we're going to see this team build around long term. I think it's more sustainable if you also have some of your veterans playing at a high level as well. Annie Kim, who's been in the program forever, Nicole Abelard, who had a pretty, I think, intriguing resume when she transferred in from Coastal Carolina. Maybe we didn't see it as consistently last year, and you're definitely seeing it, I think, more consistently than we have since you joined the program this spring. And to also to have that and also have still the excitement of the freshman who did so well in the fall, I think that's why, taking my temperature in the two programs, I'm more excited about the women's team than the men's team. Not that there isn't one specific individual in the men's team who isn't doing quite well and isn't having a fantastic year, but I think it's easier to talk yourself into a team when you have a number of potential high-level performers, like the women's golf team, I think, has shown both recently and really over the course of the full season from fall to present.
Yeah, and getting to that men's team, they opened spring play with back-to-back second-place finishes at the Border Olympics in Laredo and then the Bayou City Collegiate Classic, which, as you might guess from the name, was here in Houston. The second-place finishes, that was always good, but, you know, weren't against the strongest of fields in those events, unfortunately. In the Border Olympics, the only top 50 team was number 30, Baylor, who took first place ahead of Houston. And then back in Houston, the only top 50 team in the Bayou City Collegiate Classic was number 49, Southern Miss, who probably wasn't top 50 afterwards because they finished near the middle of the pack in that one. You know, so no, not the strongest field, but if that's who you're going to face, you want to do well. Houston did that. Santiago de la Fuente took the individual title at the Border Olympics. And then the Cougs turned around and went very much in the opposite direction in terms of quality of competition. They took part in the Cabo Collegiate, which featured the top four teams, all four of them, the top four teams in the country. The Cougs finished in 10th place out of 15 teams, but I would argue probably a better result than their prior two top two finishes, because it was just an incredibly strong field. The Cougs finished ahead of three top 20 ranked teams in Tennessee, Oklahoma State, and Alabama. And then most recently, earlier today on Tuesday, actually, they just finished up the All-American Intercollegiate up in Humble. The Cougs finished 8th out of 21 teams. Not much shame in finishing behind the teams that Houston finished behind in that one, which were mostly ranked teams, but the Cougs also didn't really finish ahead of anybody of note. So no expert, but I feel like the Cougs will probably stay about the same spot after that event in the golf stat team rankings as they are now, which is currently number 46. And you know, you kind of mentioned it, that the women's team, it's been impressive what they've done in terms of depth. And the men's team, I think the reason that it's easy to say that they're the less exciting of the two programs right now, of the two golfs, if you will, is that it's basically just been the Santiago de la Fuente show. The junior Arkansas Tech transfer has been routinely Houston's leading golfer. Like I said, won the Border Olympics individual title, finished tied for third on the individual leaderboard this past weekend at the All-American Intercollegiate. And he's someone, you know, with eligibility left, so he's someone for maybe, you know, going into next year, you can build around. And certainly, you know, at the very least, it does look like Houston will probably go back to another regional this year. But you know, I think in terms of wanting to see a little bit more quality of depth around him, it hasn't been what Houston was maybe hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, you can't say anything bad about what Santiago de la Fuente has done. His first year competing at Division I after being a really exceptional Division II golfer at Arkansas Tech, and has been very reliably since the fall your leading golfer week in, week out. But the problem is, unlike the women's team, kind of a contrast to what I said earlier, you just haven't really seen anyone consistently step up outside of De La Fuente. There are veteran golfers in your regular tournament fives, but it's been mostly Santiago De La Fuente kind of carrying it for the team, which it can work. And I mean, this is a top 50 golf stat team last I saw, and this is a team that should be back in the regional. But despite, I would say at this point, conclusively having your best golf in the program since Michael Paris, I don't think this is an appreciably better team than last year's team, despite having somebody who individually I would say is definitely appreciably better than any of the guys on last year's team.
All right, Sam. Well, I think that's where we're going to go ahead and call it quits. So on our way out, want to give a big thank you to our Scott Holman podcast Patreon supporters. Did want to mention we do have some more premium episodes coming out in the next week or so. So be on the lookout for those. If you do enjoy the work that Sam and I do, and you feel like $5 a month is something that you can afford, and you want to support Sam and I and or get access to that bonus content, you can do both of those things by going to patreon.com/shpodcast. We also do love hearing from you, the listener. You can email us shpodcast@gmail.com. You can encourage our ongoing Twitter degeneracy by following us on Twitter as long as that site is still around. At shpodcast is our Twitter handle. And that's it. So if you made it all the way to the end of this rambling episode, congratulations. You are an absolute rock star. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap.